Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Living Mythology, I'm proud to bring you Scholars from the Edge of Time with Nicholas Dyack and Michelle Brittany. And today they're taking us on a voyage to the future. Greetings and welcome, O Scholars.
Greetings, Hercules. How are you this evening?
I'm doing incredibly awesome and looking forward to your show.
It's good to hear you, sir. We hope the new year is off to a good start for you and you had some good holidays.
Yes, I did. I actually enjoyed myself a great deal. We live in challenging times and all of us have challenges, but many good things are happening. So I'm very glad of that.
Yeah, we got some optimism over here, and there's
good.
Definitely, what should I say? The movie we're about to talk about, Yore, has loads of optimism in it.
I would say it does.
So this is continuing our Sword and Planet talks that we've been doing the last couple episodes. We talked about ice pirates.
Yay.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about Valerian.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed one of those got the yay. We talked about John Carter.
We did.
And now we're talking about Yor.
Yahoo!
So I'll give a plot first, but before we actually go into us talking about Yor, we actually have kind of a personal connection with Yor. Enter from the future. But first, what is Yor? So here's a quick plot.
Well, before you talk about the plot, Hercules, have you had the pleasure of watching Yor, the Hunter from the Future?
Yes, but it's been many years since I've seen Yor. I remember it was a very unusual film, and I like unusual films. I find out from Brian Walker of Brian Shriven Theater that it was originally cobbled together from a miniseries, which explained a lot. I had heard over the years that they were making a sequel, which I don't know if they ever did, but I wish they did. But I remember enjoying the movie a great deal and watching it endlessly when I first got it on VHS. And I believe I may have it on DVD or Blu-ray.
Yeah, it just came out on Blu-ray within the past 5 years or so. It definitely came out in the mid-2010s. So there's a nice Blu-ray copy out there from Mill Creek that's got Yor's commentary in it. So,
oh, awesome.
All right, so the plot. Well, you said the movie's unusual. It is that, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
In a prehistoric land, in a mysterious and dangerous world, there is Yor. Kala and Pag are out hunting when they are attacked by a triceratops. From the jungle, Yor emerges and slays the dinosaur. They return to Kala's camp, where they feast and dance. But then they're attacked by a tribe of cavemen who kill all the men and take all the women and children. And Kala is eventually taken too. And Yor, who's in pursuit, is thrown off into a canyon to die. But Yor does not die. He's practically unhurt. He climbs up and turns a giant pterodactyl bat thing into a glider and rides into the cave to save Kala. Yor smashes open a subterranean dam, flooding the tunnels and killing the cavemen. And maybe the women they took too, because Yor kind of forgets about them. And instead, travels to a desert where he meets another woman named Roa, who has the most perfectly formed bangs on her forehead. She and Yor have mysterious medallions. They come from the same place. So Yor kills all the fire people that hold Roa captive, and it collapses the cave on them. Now the crew wants to travel to Yor's world, where he came from, Garaf. But Roa and Kala, they get really catty and jealous of each other. They want Yor for themselves. But then they're ambushed by the leader of the cavemen, the ones from before that all should have died. But no, there's a couple left. Yor easily dispatches them, not before Roa dies. So they make it to a beach, and they see the ocean, and they kill another dinosaur, and they meet a village of other folks. And if you're thinking that there's a pattern emerging here, that for every group of people your encounters, they get killed, you are 100% correct, because spaceships come in and blast the village. So finally, Yorg, Pag, and Kala take a boat to an island surrounded by storms, which capsizes them because they are prehistoric people, and how on earth do they know how to operate a sailboat anyway? Yor is now taken captive by the Overlord and his army of androids. It turns out Yor's parents were rebels to the Overlord, but they died, and they sent Yor to the mainland, which long ago was ravaged by nuclear holocaust. So how did Yor grow up? Who took care of him? How did he learn to hunt? How did he learn to speak? How did he learn to do anything? We'll never know. A giant fight breaks out between the Overlord and his Darth Vader-looking androids and the rebels, who look like members of a New Wave band. They, of course, win, and they fly off into the sunset, into
Yor's world.
Yay!
I think what's surprising about that entire plot synopsis...
It's accurate.
It's accurate, but this is only an 88-minute movie, and yet you manage... A lot of material, a lot of worlds, a lot of different species or, you know, groups of people.
Yeah, just like kind of some of the other films we've talked about here, it sounds like I'm making fun of the film, and kind of am a little bit, because it's so fun. This is actually an enjoyable film, and we'll get into why in a second, but I would say out of the four Sworded Planet films we watched, this is probably... Well, I think Ice Pirates is probably the best crafted. Yours is probably the best fun.
Well, yes, but I also think that Yor's World has a lot of points to it.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of creativity in it that I think gives it an opportunity to stand out on its own, too.
So we actually have a connection with this film. It goes back to the mid-2000s. So I think we'll open with that before.
And I have a connection probably, too.
You probably have a connection, too. So
yeah.
So back in the mid-2000s, both Michelle and I were students at University of Washington in Tacoma, and I was working on my master thesis for Antonio Margheriti. So at that time, I was collecting every Margheriti film I could get my paws on. But this was the 2000s, so this is kind of before, like, cult boutique movie places took off, like, you know, Severin and Vinegar Syndrome. So a lot of the films I actually couldn't get, but I could find them on VHS. And the school we went to actually had an AV room that you could put a VHS tape in, and as the movie played, it would rip it to a DVD. And so a lot of the marker films at the time, there was no DVDs of them, but I was able to eBay a lot of them on VHS, and at the time, that was the only way to get Yor, and so I had this VHS copy of Yor, burned it to a DVD-R, and that's how we watched Yor the first time, and I think I've got a couple passing mentions of Yor in my thesis, so yay. So that's
well, and you're this was actually on Castle Blood.
Correct. I laser focused, like, the first third of my thesis was Margheriti is really great. Here's why. Now let's look at, you know, one movie of his, which was Castle of Blood. But I think a giant monograph could be written about Yor. That's a different project.
Oh, yeah.
Later, I was able to import a German version on DVD. So, yay. Got the soundtrack. But in 2010, Michelle and I took an adventure to SoCal before we moved there because they used to have little, you know, celebrity autograph meet and greet shows.
Yeah, called the Hollywood Collectors Show. And they would do them once a quarter. And they would bring in various celebrities. And they would typically do themed. So, like, they had happy days. They'd had reunions of them. Laverne and Shirley. And I'm actually not sure how...
They did a Blade Runner reunion we went to?
And Terminator, I believe,
yep.
And others. But Red Brown was at one of these collector shows.
Yes, Mr. Yor himself was at the show. So I meekly go up to this towering mass of a man, because even though he was like 60 years old, I'm sorry, Yor is ripped. I mean, Yor in real life, Red Brown, even though he's older, he was still a ripped dude. And, you know, so we actually, you know, there was no one else around because they're all busy doing other things. So we got to hang out with Red Brown for quite a while. He signed my copy of the German version of Yor. He actually signs copies of Yor as Yours Truly. Signed my copy of Strike Commando. He signed my copy of Space Mutiny. I mean, these are all, you know, films that, you know, get lampooned or made fun of, but, you know, we enjoy them. And he told us some stories about making Yor, and it was a very positive experience for sure. And of course we had our photos with him, and Michelle's going in for big hugs because that's what she does.
He was easy to hug.
He's a big mountain of a dude.
And what's kind of interesting is that last night we listened to the commentary that you can get on the Blu-ray version of Mill Creek, right?
Yeah, the Mill Creek version.
And Red Brown talks a lot about his experience, and he was actually talking about how he was about 230 pounds, and I think he dropped about 20 or 25 pounds through the filming or the production.
Because of working conditions.
Working conditions. And I think we should talk on that in a little bit. But for a fellow that was even 230, I mean, he looked like powerhouse Luford, like you said, ripped. But yeah, and when we met him, I couldn't believe how old he was, because I think he was probably early 60s at the time. And he was in great shape. Definitely still working out and things like that. Mm-hmm. And just the sweetest person that you could meet. We met a lot of very nice people over the years, and he stands out as one of the favorites.
That's probably why one of the reasons we were a little bit appreciative of Yor, just because we met the guy, did my thesis on the director. So we have a little bit more, we cheer for the film. But it is, I don't want to say psychotronic, but it is definitely a trip at how outlandish this is, especially for an Italian film, because in the 80s they got really weird. So let's. I think we'll now move on to actually talking about the film. But that's our background with Yor. We love Yor. So I think the first thing to talk about is the genre of it, because this is kind of, you know, in our Sword and Planet talks of films, and this movie is definitely a sword and something. It's not quite Sword and Sandal, because there's futuristic elements, mm-hmm. but there's like strong prehistoric peplum elements, like 60,000 BC and Apocalyptico, I think that's the movie. It's not quite sword and sorcery because there's no magic, but the landscape is very alien, and it feels like a Ralph Bashke film, like Fire and Ice. And it's not quite Sword and Planet because it's kind of ambiguous. I think it leans heavily toward this is Earth in the future, kind of like Thundar the Barbarian. Yet the cover has UFOs. There's the other artwork that shows space cities, and there's some Star Wars elements. So it's like grabbing a bit of each of the sword and something genres to become Yor. At the very least, we know this is in that post-Conan wave of films, because when Conan came out in 82, there was American sword and sorcery, and there was Italian sword and sorcery. And this is definitely cashing in on that.
Yeah. Nick, like you've studied over the years with regards to like the peplum, that you would get the cycles that you would then have, you know, the European ripoff. And I really think that Margaretti was cashing in on not only like Conan the Barbarian and Beastmaster, which had come both had come out the year before, but also the Star Wars, it's 1999, like some of the costumes in Yor's world is, I think, based on the Space 1999 television series that was on in America. There's also there's a lower technology or production value that would almost be in the range of Logan's Run.
Uh-huh.
So there's this real mishmash, which, of course, Margaretti would have been very familiar with.
Well, there's one other film you thought this was very akin to, the futuristic post-apocalyptic.
Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. I think the movie is shooting to be futuristic Earth, but part of me just thinks because the movie is so weird and out there, it can only exist in its own, you know, planet or world. Some other kind of elements, you know, the Star Wars element is the androids, they have that kind of Darth Vader back of the helmet thing going on. John Steiner, who plays the Overlord, he's cloaked and he looks a lot like Palpatine.
Mm-hmm.
And the other movie, I don't know if these came out after, but in the 80s, they made two kind of side Star Wars films, the two Ewok films, Ewok's Battle for Endor and the Great Ewok Adventure, whatever it's called. And, you know, they're Star Wars, they're Sword and Planet, but, you know, there's like witches and magic in them, and it's very low-tech looking. They're basically sword and sorcery on another planet. And York kind of has... I hate to say it, the feel of an Ewok film at times, or at least one of those.
Particularly when it's in the forested area.
Mm-hmm.
So this film was shot in Turkey, and it was at the Cappadocia Mountains. So they're very kind of like otherworldly, very desolate type of alien kind of landscape, and I think we realized you found that the Turkish Star Wars was filmed in the same kind of locale.
Yeah. So in the early 80s, before Margaretti at the time was shooting either in the Philippines or you shooting in Turkey, and a lot of the Turkish actors, you know, made their way into genre films. So there is, of course, the infamous Turkish Star Wars, and I don't remember it's like literal translation. It's like Man of the Atom or something. It's basically that they splice in footage from Star Wars, and that's about as zany as Yor is, if not more so. But actors in that are in Yor, and I say this unironically, but one of my top five all-time favorite films is Margaretti's Ark of the Sun God. And that's not a peplum. That's like a James Bond meets Cat Burglar meets Indiana Jones film. But that, too, was shot in Turkey in Istanbul in the Cappadocia Mountains and stuff. And so the actors from Turkish Star Wars and Yor also appear in that film. So different dialogue, but folks who have not seen Ark of the Sun God, that I stand by it. That's a legit good film, even though it's got crazy miniature works and it's kind of Orbeck. Come on.
That says it right there.
But like you're saying, like the Cappadocia landscape is very alien. And it's, because it's so rocky and barren, it makes me think of like He-Man. You know, He-Man is fighting Skeletor. You know, it's very rocky. Mm-hmm. There's the castle in the background. And even makes me think of Fire and Ice when the dude goes off into, like, well, the guy's castle full of lava. It's all rocky and everything. So that's where that kind of sword and sorcery imagery really, really comes from. And so, again, it's a sword and something film. It's definitely trying to capture peplum elements for her sorcery elements and planet elements. Peplum, though, what makes a peplum most of the time, is our hero, Red Brown Yor. He is definitely in that lineage of the Hercules type, the Ursus type, the all those, you know, strong men of the 60s. Red Brown is, you know, the 80s version of that. And, of course, you know, the 80s would also see, like, the Barbarians film with the two twins and the rise of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And, you know, Red Brown is, like, you know, the middle of that tradition.
And I would say that, you know, as far as presence and appearance-wise, I would say probably a little more buff than Mark Singer as Beastmaster, but not over masculinized like you had Arnie as Conan and the twins in that movie that you were referencing.
And it might be he's not overly masculinized because he's got that awful blonde wig. So he looks like a pretty boy at times. Side note, in the commentary, he makes fun of that wig all the time, so he's in on it. they should have just left it off. But yeah, he's definitely glammed up. And, of course, in a normal strongman fashion, his body is on display. The only thing he's wearing is loincloth and fur boots. Everything else, you know, there is plenty of bicep shots, chest shots, butt shots when he's climbing up things.
You actually see derrieres in this film. It's a PG, but, I mean, it's unusual that you'd see derrieres.
And just like a classic peplum, you know, the women are also on display. You know, they're not covered, like, in veils or anything, but like Raquel Welch in 20,000 BC, it's fur bikinis and midriffs and whatnot. But Red Brown, he's a peplum star. He's a strong man. He has his various feats of strength in the film. And I think one of the most interesting feats of strength is his, I'm going to say, invulnerability, because there is that scene. He is seriously hooked, crashes at the bottom of a canyon. And anyone else, that would kill. And I think that would even kill, you know, a 60s, peplum person, like, you know, Ursus, you know, I'm sorry, Ursus was a pretty strong guy, but if you threw him in the bottom of the canyon, he's going to go splat. But he just wakes up, he's barely unfazed, there's no broken bones, no nothing, he just climbs out of there and keeps going on his way.
Now, I'd love to interject on that, because I got the impression that a tree broke his fall, and that he was actually still, that he wasn't that far down and that he was able to climb back up, that he actually landed kind of in a tree right near, you know.
That's still going to break all the bones in his body.
Well, not if it's not very far. But the other guy that got chucked over, he definitely went all the way down.
He kind of chucked in a canyon. He went splat on the bottom. And he made it. And that, to me, that's impressive, you know. You know, rock climbing and being tossed over a cliff.
But for being invulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Gets hurt.
Well, yes, he still gets hurt, but he's also, he doesn't do it himself, and that's what makes him kind of an interesting hero.
Yes. 90% of the movie, he's with two companions. You know, the sword and sorcery film, you got to have henchmen. There's Kala, the lady who has big poofy permed hair, as was custom in the 80s, and you got her companion, this old man named Pag, who's played by Alan Collins, who also starred in every single Italian film ever made. He was in a lot of giallos. He was called the Italian Peter Lorre, because when he was younger, he looked like Peter Lorre. But in this film, he plays a short old man, and typically in a film like this, if you're a short old man, you don't make it far. And he lives through the entire film. He doesn't, you know, doesn't get hurt. And he actually does a lot of fighting. His forte is archery. He just sits back and goes pew, pew, like freaking Legolas from the Lord of the Rings film. He's basically an Italian less attractive Legolas. But he helped out when yours in the middle of melee, he just goes pew, pew, pew with his arrows, and he takes people down. And it's actually neat to see, because, again, that's the type of character that doesn't fight. You know, they stay in the back. They eventually get clobbed on the head. They die in the hero's arms. Like, get revenge for me and my tribe and my daughter, you know, that's the type of character he should be playing.
Right, and we see that with a lot of the other characters throughout the film, like Nick was alluding to before, is that chaos seems to follow Yor, and, you know, if he comes a-running, you know, the village should probably move.
His intentions are there, but like you said, the chaos is right behind.
But the fact that Peg is an unusual sidekick. He's very effective, and he holds his own. He also plays a kind of a dual role, because not only does he bring to the table his fighting prowess, he also has an intellect, and so he's also kind of, in lieu of not having a wizard, he's kind of an oracle, and he, throughout the entire film, he talks about pearls of wisdom, and he talks about how, you know, well, he'll make observations that are very astute, and kind of brings in that other element that is missing from what would be a regular sword and sandal, sword and sorcery type of film.
Well, in a sword and sorcery film, you would have that band of adventurers, and you would have the wizard or the seer who doesn't really fight, but, you know, they're along, they're a lot of times they're documenting, you know, the hero's travels as well. They kind of stay out of it, but they also are the consultancy of it. But yeah, you're right. He's the combination of of a wizard and a ranger, even though he's a short, stocky man. You know what he is? In Dungeons and Dragons terms, he's a dual class dwarf. That's what I would put.
There we go.
But yeah, so that kind of bucks the trend. The other trend that is really out there is hold on, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yore also uses, for the most of the time, and that's the asterisk here, melee weapons. And like a typical, we bring this up all the time, sword and sandal hero, you know, the weapons are disposable. You know, they're supposed to be the extension of his strength. You fight the sword, you lose the sword. That's okay because you got your fists. You are very, you know, strong. That's what the important thing is. And Yore is exact same way in the classic strongman mold. He goes through weapons like Kleenex. He starts out with an axe, he loses the axe, he gets a cudgel, he loses the cudgel, he has a knife on his side. He uses a lot of melee weapons that are, you know, extension of his strength. He also uses a lot of his fists. He has that classic, you know, Captain Kirk thing where you take out the Gorn by putting your hands together and go pow on their back. I don't know if that works in real life, but Yore certainly has that Captain Kirk move. But there is one thing he does that I've never seen, and it's probably because of setting, another sword and sandal character do. He uses a weapon, a gun, in this case a laser gun. So just give him a revolver. They give him a laser gun. So there's a brief sequence at the end of the film where you have a Peplum character using a ranged firearm, and that's like, no, you don't do that. But on the other hand, I mean, it works for the setting, but it's so unusual. It's one of the other aspects of the film that kind of bucks the genre trend.
I would also say that there is a scene in the film where he is saving Roa from the diseased people.
The desert, they call them, the desert people. You know, I think they're supposed to be a play on Tuscan Raiders from Tatooine.
Because actually that's why they have that kind of sandy looking outfit. And they've got their faces painted. But in that particular juncture, they have a relic, a ritual relic, which is a burning sword, a flaming sword. And so that's one of the times it's rather interesting because Yore has this flaming sword, and it's pretty impressive. It's also very scary given the fact that I think he did most, if not all, of his own stunts. And in Italian production, safety is not number one. And
no, they're not.
And, you know, it's pretty impressive that he's walking around with this flaming sword, swiping at people. It's amazing that they didn't have deaths or injuries on there. But
it's actually, I have that down. It's a cool looking scene. It's not necessarily because strongmen use swords. He's using a sword, but it is a flame. It's and again, we got, you know, it's not quite a sorted sorcery film. There isn't really any magic, but there might be magic here, or it could just be a sword coating in oil, and that's their ritual. Who knows? But it looks very impressive, and there is actually a scene. They mimic the scene on one of the posters, and that's what they use on the slipcase of the Blu-ray, where he's standing there with the sword at his side, and he's all buffed out. It's actually really cool looking. It looks like, and there's a reason probably why they put that on the poster, because it's a nice looking scene of a strong man using, in this case, a fiery sword. I guess I also would anticipate the Thunder of the Barbarian cartoon, because he has the light sword, and that's not quite fire, but, you know, he's a barbarian of a sword.
Well, and that kind of goes in line with Margaretti saying, okay, well, you know, he probably wasn't thinking, oh, well, down in the climactic scene, I'll have a lightsaber or, you know, a laser, but what else can I have that's kind of a lightsaber?
Uh-huh.
And this is one of those things. I think that that particular area also helps with establishing Yor and Roa, by extension, the mythology that we always see in a lot of the sword and fill-in-the-blank type of films.
Yeah, this film tries to make it some kind of mythology where when Yor appears, you know, he's a barbarian, he's got this medallion around him. It's not a magic medallion. It's basically, it's the best way to describe it is it's recording what's going on with him.
Which is a neat idea,
it is.
Actually.
It's something that in more capable hands would probably have produced kind of better results. But he's oblivious to that. Cause at the end of the film, the Overlord takes his medallion, puts it into a computer, basically like a floppy disk. And there's Yor's memories, sort of. They only played one memory where he's already an adult, and Yor exclaims, that's when I was learning to hunt. I'm like, you're already an adult. Come on. But that's the idea here is he's not amnesiac, but he's not raised by anyone. So there's that kind of Ursus in the Valley of the Lions quality where, you know, you're a feral person raised by animals, but that's not really in this case. But it adds to that kind of, like, what Michelle's saying, there's a mythology here. It's a prehistoric world. There's sci-fi elements. It is psychotronic, but there is an actual world building here, and how did you get to this world?
Yeah, in fact, we even, Nick and I were discussing offline last night about, we actually wondered, okay, did he just kind of grow really fast? Did he just kind of fall to Earth? Kind of like Starman, where it's an alien, he falls to Earth, and then, you know, you see the morphosis and he becomes an adult very, very quickly. And we even kind of like tossed around the idea of like, well, you know, how do you resolve that? Because that is left ambiguous.
Yeah, there's some edits in this film where I don't think it was intentional, but at least some gaps. Like the aforementioned, when Yor floods the cave, it cuts to a shot of like the women he's supposed to be saving. And then you don't see him again. And I think the implication is they died. And I don't think that's what it's supposed to happen. I think it's supposed to show them that it's saved, but it's just bad editing. And the same thing with, like, trying to explain Yor's past. They just never show, like a younger Yor. They show a baby Yor, like, in a flashback. But what you have to do to fix it is show one scene of Yor, like, as an 8-year-old, throwing an arrow at someone. And now you've solved that mystery of, you know, was he a kid? Because there's the heavily implication that there's genetic engineering going on at the end of the film. Maybe he's a super person where, like Starman, you know, he arrives, he's a kid for like an hour, and all of a sudden now he's an adult. It's
because there is kind of an innocence and about Yor, and we discover very, very close to the end of the film that his original name is Galahad, and so that's an interesting connection because Galahad is, of course, one of the Knights of the Round Table who went out and to seek the Holy Grail, but he's also known as like one of the most gallant and pure Knights of the Round Table, and I think that Yor does kind of embody that, those values.
When you say that, I just got two and two together. You know who Yor is very much reminiscent of? Like someone who wants to do good. He's got high knight-like values. But even though he succeeds, chaos is in his wake.
Mm-hmm.
Don Quixote.
Oh, yeah.
He's a very much a Don Quixote character. Because he does have this unflappable optimism. He's got a very youthful face. And he does spouse, you know, kind of these platitudes of, your robots are just puppets. You just want to rule puppets, overlord? He's like, well, actually, yeah, I do. He has kind of a moral compass, a right and wrong. You brought up Hero's Journey when we were talking offline last night. And, this isn't really a Hero's Journey film. I don't think it's a Hero's Journey film per se because I don't think, grows as a character. But he's already set with those heroic values. In fact, even Pag comments on I think he says something like, he does what his heart tells him, which is running into battle and killing dinosaurs to save people, because he does it twice.
Yeah.
And Pag does mention something along those lines that's him. Excuse me, I got a little bit of a cough going on. I'm sorry. I'm not quite as immortal as you're here. What else?
Are you okay?
Oh, yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, it's just, January allergy season.
I think, what about a little bit about Margheriti and what he as a director brings to this film? Because there's definitely, Margheriti.
Trademarks.
And even though he was we've talked about the fact that he's a paycheck director, there are elements that does create him as kind of an auteur.
Mm-hmm. To me, Margheriti's the best Italian director. I mean, most people put, especially in the horror genre, Mario Bava and Dario Argento as their respective one and twos. Most people, when they think of Margheriti, they might think of Castle of Blood, which is probably his best crafted film. But one of the hallmarks, there's two hallmarks of Margheriti, and they feed into each other. The first one is his subject matter is, and I write about this in my thesis actually, the fantastique. He does fantasy and sci-fi the most. Early in his career, he practically carved out the sci-fi genre in Italy. He did his Gamma 1 quadrilogy and Assignment Outer Space. I mean, that's him. There wasn't anyone else doing space movies. But how do you do space movies? How do you do sci-fi and fantasy movies? Well, before you have CGI, before you have a budget, before you have blue screens, and before you have matte paintings, you have miniatures. And man, does Margheriti love his miniatures. They're not always the most convincing miniatures, but they're pretty good. And this film has quite a few miniatures in it. When he breaks the dam and it floods, that's obviously a miniature.
But very well done.
Pretty well done.
Mm-hmm.
He also uses, they're not animatronics, obviously, but he does have actors, including his son, inside the dinosaurs, moving them around, going, rawr. Now, up close, they look very paper mache-ish, but when the camera's at a little wider angle, they look pretty good.
Yeah, and in fact, that just reminded me that there was like a POV shot from the kind of like top of the head of one of the dinosaurs.
Both of them.
Oh, was it both of them?
Yeah, but the Triceratops even more so.
Where you actually see the fight from the perspective of the dinosaur, which gives, a more fuller visual of just the prowess of, I think, and fighting the dinosaurs.
I was thinking of the POV shot because I've seen those in other Italian films. I wasn't thinking of it in terms of that's the POV of the dinosaur. But now that you bring that up, it reminds me of Italians, they do POV shots quite a bit. And the one I always think of is Lucio Fulci's Zombie, when it shows the conquistador zombies rising from the grave, you actually get their POV. And I think it's one of the only instances in all zombie films where you see the world through the eyes of a zombie. It's a little side note there, but yeah, the dinosaur POVs definitely fall. I mean, how many other films do dinosaur POVs? I think Carnosaur might. I think he sees it infrared and eats people.
Oh, okay. Alrighty.
But he
also reuses actors. So
he does a lot of special effects.
Yes.
There's lasers. There's
and this is all practical
miniatures.
Effects
yeah.
that are in Yorn. Actually, Reb Brown talks about a lot of the physical effects.
Uh-huh.
Practical effects that they do. And, you know, he, after all this time, was even just really impressed with how well the films looked, given the low budget, the fact that these were practical effects that were being done at the time.
You know, at the end of the day, you know, I think a bad practical, I think we talked about this and some other people have this ideology, a bad or subpar practical effect will still be leagues better than a not so good CGI effect.
And
that's just kind of the way it is. So there's special effects galore in this film.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most convincing special effects is when they have Alan Collins, aka Pat. Again, he's a small old man with a coffee stained beard. He is able to acrobatically do a flip thing on a rope to rescue Yor over a computer canyon. You know, one of those, you know, kind of Tarzan swings, but he's able to flip himself upside down so his arms are hanging down so he can grab Yor and bring him to the other side.
It was like circular leg type of maneuver, and it's kind of like, this is an old man and how is he so limber? So, you know, there is kind of jumping the shark in a couple of places with regards to this character, but, you know, again, it's Margot Reddy giving more time and playing with those stereotypes in a different way and twisting them on themselves. I think he does that with Tay Lee a little bit, even though she is kind of the damsel in distress at times.
And catty.
There's some cattiness going on. Roa most definitely is the damsel in distress. But Kaylee, a couple of times, is shown, you know, hunting. She's definitely carrying her own weight as far as, like, within a village and being more, more proactive and more engaged than, you know, someone that's a damsel that doesn't do anything.
Well, we're introduced to her that it's her and Pag hunting.
You know,
she's part of the, now, granted, they have to get saved, but still, you know, she's leading up Pag. She's the one hunting.
Yeah, and she's actually the one that grabs, is able to trap the little dinosaur that brings the big dinosaur out. But, you know, she's no slouch at doing her part.
But she also has this uncanny actual personality trait of Tag will say, you stay here. And she'd be like, sucker, I'm taking off and doing my own thing.
Yeah.
She kind of does that a lot.
And in fact, one of the other things when they're out at the beach, she's fishing and Pag is actually doing the cooking.
Oh, yeah.
And Yor, our intrepid hero, is sleeping.
Rewinding a bit, Margot Reddy and characters.
Yes,
Margot Reddy reuses, that's probably his third, and it's probably because that's Italian cinema. A lot of the films have the same director, the same production crew. But I feel like Margot Reddy, his main actors, he uses quite a bit in his films. In this film, you definitely have Alan Collins. Alan Collins, I think, is in, like, every single Margot Reddy film. I swear, he's in all of them. But he's definitely in Ark of the Sun God. I think he's in Hunters from the Golden Cobra. He's in everything. And, of course, you've got, and I don't remember their names, unfortunately, but the Turkish actors are all in Margot Reddy's Turkish films. And, of course, John Steiner. John Steiner, if the movie doesn't have Alan Collins, which it probably will have, it next has John Steiner, who is in also everything Margot Reddy made, from Ark of the Sun God to this and many other films. Of course, he was
a lot of the jungle films. Oh, if you had David Warbeck, you always had John Steiner.
That's right. They were in The Last Hunter together. John Steiner was playing like the head of an abandoned army base. And that's the scene where they shove cigarettes up their nose.
Yes.
Sorry, that's a different joke, different episode. But there's this, not in this film, but there's also a string of mercenary films that Margheriti made in the 80s that had Lewis Collins in it and also John Steiner and a couple German actors. So it gives the Margheriti films, because he uses a lot of the same actors, it gives his body of work this kind of canon continuity quality to them. They're not sequels or prequels or remakes of each other, and they're all different characters, but just visually, with his special effects, his miniatures, and his cast, you know, it's one of those films that you can look at and say, that's a Margheriti film. You can look at Yore and have a good laugh, but you'll immediately, just like watching a Mario Bava film, you can pick up the lighting, you can watch Dario Argento film and pick up the soundtrack. You could visually look at a frame of Margheriti and Yore and know that that's him.
I would say also, I'm just kind of doing a quick look on Margheriti. He did many, many films. He had a very long career in film.
And he did Peplum.
He did Peplum. He actually started filming, it looks like, in about 1950, around 53. And if the name Antonio Margheriti sounds familiar, he's also was used, at least his name, was an alias in an undercover operation in Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. It was the Eli Roth character. And Tarantino, again, made reference to Margheriti in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, we haven't seen that one yet.
Mm-mm. But in said film, apparently Leonardo DiCaprio portrays a fictional B-list character actor named Rick Dalton, who goes to Italy in 1969 to film spaghetti westerns, including one spy thriller directed by Margheriti titled Operazione Dynamite. So Margheriti has a little bit of a legacy out there as well. And, of course, his son has been in...
Eduardo
has been in films, did production level type, like B team.
Assistant directing and special effects.
Yeah. Something that we wanted to bring up, too, before our time runs out, is that this is probably one of the early or maybe one of Margheriti's films that was actually backed by an American company.
Yeah, Columbia. You know, back in the day, you know, even though Italian films were exported over the seas, you know, European market, American market, you know, the American markets that bought them up were usually, you know, B-grade Roger Corman-esque distributors. And, you know, that went into the 80s as well. I mean, even Charles Band, before he made Full Moon and Empire, he had a distribution, I think it was just called Media or something like that, had to move these movies around. So this is a rare instance of a big Western company scooping up a film and releasing it.
And that was Columbia Pictures that distributed it. And they actually did a media event with Rev Brown in Hollywood on Beverly Boulevard or Sunset in his Your outfit out on the street. I'm getting a lot of looks, he said, in his commentary of the film.
I think one last thing to bring up, going back to Margheriti and his penchant for fantasy and sci-fi, we mentioned earlier, this is a rare instance that a Peplum hero uses like a pistol/laser weapon. I think it's also a rare opportunity to explore that man versus machine theme that was getting popular in that post-Kraftwerk era. I mean, movies like Terminator and, you know, whatnot were becoming very in vogue. But, you know, this is an actual barbarian peplum hero fighting machines. And that's kind of a live-action rarity back then, I would think.
I'm just looking up Terminator to see when that came out.
84?
It is actually 84. So that kind of idea, Margheriti, once again, is kind of ahead of his time.
Yeah, as a side note, if I recall the legend of Terminator, James Cameron got the idea when he was working on the Italian film Piranha 2, The Spawning. There's this another B-movie Italian connection there. But yeah, there's a man versus machine element that you wouldn't normally have, like in a classic 60s peplum. I mean, the technology that they would showcase in antiquity, you know, would be catapults and trebuchets. And I just can't, well, I guess I can imagine a Hercules character going up there and going, and ripping them apart. But, you know, that's probably not as impressive as, I mean, it is impressive, but, you know, a barbarian fighting a robot. And now, side note, the robots in this film, they are not very convincing. They are pretty bad, but, you know, they're obviously dudes in suits. But, you know, the idea, though, is a very, you know, the only other thing I could think of that would come before that would be, like, Chewbacca fighting droids in a Star Wars film, but he's not a man, he's a Wookiee.
Yeah. Kind of going with the whole Conan the Barbarian Beastmaster is the fact that this Yor was based off of a comic book, an Argentine comic book that was written, and it was reprinted in Italy. And
where's the English version?
Yeah, it would be kind of interesting to take a look at that. But apparently, Margheriti had seen that and does comment that he was influenced by that comic book series that had been reprinted in Italy. So just kind of interesting that there, you know, here's another kind of interesting connection with another media, like we had with Conan and with Beastmaster, I believe. So, I'm trying to think if there was anything else that we missed.
That's pretty much it. I think, you know, at the end, it's got charming errors, you know, wigs that don't quite look right, paper mache dinosaurs, editing that leaves plot holes, sci-fi settings that are just converted factories with lots of pipes and stuff. But there's this charm to it that's, you know, that would be absent from a movie that would be a more serious Italian film, I think. And so it's enjoyable. It's very action-oriented. There's very few scenes where, you know, where they stop and just kind of meander. I mean, they do walk from place to place, but it's really quickly filled with, I'm fighting a dinosaur. I'm fighting a caveman. I'm fighting another caveman. I'm fighting sand people that are kind of Tusken Raider-ish. Now there's spaceships firing lasers. Now I'm on a boat in a storm. It actually has this really quick pace to it that doesn't let up.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's very much an adventure film, and it does go very quickly. Well, I think on that note, Hercules, do you have questions for us?
No, it was a very entertaining presentation. I laughed quite a lot, and thank you for that. I really think we should petition to get that comic book available in English, and also the TV show, the miniseries. There was 5 episodes that Yor was cut from. I think we should be able to watch the entire series. That might fill up some of the holes in the plot.
I'm just reading. It says that the film was originally planned as a 4-part miniseries with 4 15-minute segments. And this film was actually originally 98 minutes, and I guess it was cut down to 89. And then when it was distributed, they cut one more minute because it's an 88-minute film now.
But so Rev Brown also talked about it being the miniseries quality because the production of it went way beyond what it should have been to make extra shots for all that stuff.
Yeah. In fact, he said the production was supposed to be just a short 12 weeks, which, you know, is pretty long for kind of a lower budget film. And then it did go on for quite a bit longer.
Mm-hmm. So. I think the third thing that they should release is a 7-inch vinyl single. We haven't even brought this up. Great
oh, yeah.
one to
yeah.
end the show on is Your has a theme song.
Yes,
and it's
does.
It has the worst English ever, but man, is it not catchy. And that should be released as a vinyl single for Record Store Day or something.
And I'm looking it up.
Oh, do they actually have lyrics somewhere? Because I have the score. I have the score for Your, and that rhymed, and I didn't mean it to. But that iconic Your theme song is missing because the movie opens with it. Any big crescendo of action, like when he swoops in, they just play Your's World, He's the Man, Your's World. Cue it.
Well, it was released. There was a soundtrack LP released back in 1983 by Southern Cross Records. And then it looked like it was remastered and expanded into a CD. So there's a CD out there somewhere in 2011. So I think we have to do some hunting.
Worth questioning for, yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Before you share your contact information, we need to schedule the show. I'm honoring all our Sword and Sandal hosts as torchbearers of Mount Olympus this month. And I'm re-interviewing them because it's been a while since we really, you know, re-interviewed you guys in great detail and outlined your entire journey for new listeners. So I'll be contacting you about that in the days ahead.
That sounds great. We look forward to that, Hercules. We were actually talking the other day about how long we've been doing podcasting because we do also an HP Lovecast mm-hmm. podcast, which is the derivative review of derivative literature of HP Lovecraft. And wasn't it like we've been doing this for like 6 or 7 years now?
It's 2015.
Yes.
I couldn't believe it's been that long.
Yeah, it's amazing. I found I was trying to think up some ways. I'm trying to learn basic editing, and I want to put some of the old shows on YouTube. It's going very slowly. But anyway, it'll eventually happen. So I became aware of how far back our podcasts go, and they go back years.
Yeah, well, it'll be nice once they're on YouTube because I think there are lots of good information there. You know,
yes.
All of your programs. It definitely has some has great content out there. I'm like, what are you doing with your arms up?
Well,
sorry, I'm in the same. So obviously, I can see, and Nick's got his arms up.
I have every single episode at my website that we've done.
Oh, awesome. It'll make finding them a lot easier because for a couple of years, I didn't know what our status was on CERN. That was a episode by episode thing. So
oh.
I don't have links to those. So if you have links, so that'll make that work a lot easier. How can folks contact you and follow all the wonderful things that you're doing?
Well, I have a website. It's michellebrittany.com. I've also got on Amazon an author page, and then on Facebook I have a professional page. I think those are probably the best ways to contact me. Always message, so that way I know how you found me.
I'm at nickgayak.com. From there is all my links to social media that you can contact me from. A lot of my essays are there. And, yeah, a giant podcast index of all the stuff that we've done together.
Thank you so very much. You guys are awesome. And this was a phenomenally entertaining podcast. And I find all your podcasts entertaining. But today you had me laughing. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're very welcome, Hercules. I hope you have a good rest of the week. And again, Happy New Year's to yourself and to all the listeners.
And to you and yours as well as to the listeners. Thank you, all listeners, for tuning in. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you were waiting patiently in our queue, or whether you'll be checking later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you Happy New Year, joyous journeys, and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Nick and Michelle.
Oh, have a wonderful rest of the month.
You too. Bye-bye.